2024 Veterans Day edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger.
So today on Mountain Money, we're going to be joined by Professor Justine Hill Edwards. She's going to talk about her new book, The Rise and Betrayal of the Freedmen's Bank Savings and Trust.
And then we have a recorded interview with the Honorable Donald Remy, former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Veteran Affairs. All this and more on Mountain Money this wonderful Veterans Day. Stay tuned.
The end of the Civil War meant that millions of the formerly enslaved went from being property to looking for ways to accumulate property. One vehicle that was supposed to help in that endeavor was the Freedmen's Bank Savings and Trust. Marketed as a safe way for former slaves to store their money, the bank was sabotaged by insider misbehavior and ultimately failed. The story of the bank and the way its failure undermined the ongoing efforts for economic autonomy in the African American community is told in a fascinating new book, The Rise and Betrayal of Freedmen's Savings and Trust, by Professor Justine Hill Edwards. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning, Professor Edwards, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Professor Edwards, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, I'll start with the second question first. As any writer, especially any historian, knows, it does take it takes a while to do the research and conceptualize of the project. But I was really doing this research for about 4 years, and I was fortunate to have had a team of research assistants to help me wade through the thousands of pages of records. But I decided to write this book really as I was finishing my PhD in 2015. My now husband and I lived in Washington, D.C., and he would walk by the Treasury Annex, which is adjacent to the White House. Mm-hmm. And there in 2015 was erected a plaque to recognize the Freedmen's Bank. And so he asked me about it, and I had kind of known about the history of the Freedmen's Bank just from my readings on the history of Reconstruction. But as I got into looking at what other historians and scholars have written about, I realized that not much was known about it. The last book to be written about the Freedmen's Bank was published in 1976, and the book before that was published in 1927. And so I thought that now was actually a really good time to dig into the history again, especially as I was finishing my first book on the economic lives of enslaved people and thinking about all of these conversations that we have been having in our public discourse about economic equality and the racial wealth gap. So that led me to really researching and writing this book on the Freedmen's Bank.
When you talk about thousands of pages of documents, one of the things that was interesting to me is you'd be reading along the book and there'd be a vignette of so-and-so walked into the bank and deposited $21.34. That suggests to me that you found some really detailed records of the original Freedmen's Bank. Am I right?
Exactly. I mean, I think that this is just such a great project to think about what the archival record looks like. And a lot of these records are actually available online. And so, again, I worked with a team of, at any time, 4 to 5 research assistants, and I would just be wading through depositor records, kind of seeing who was depositing money in their bank accounts. I couldn't really get access to individual deposits, but I did get a sense of the kind of broad landscape of depositors. We're talking about men, women, and children who were depositing sometimes $1, sometimes $5, sometimes hundreds of dollars if they could. And so it gave me, I think, a good idea of the cross-section of African Americans who were putting their financial futures in the hands of the Freedmen's Bank deposit administrators.
Good. So John Alvord, who was he? And what was his role in causing Congress to pass legislation creating Freedmen's Bank and Trust?
Yes. Well, John Alvord was an abolitionist and minister from Connecticut, but he lived with his family in New Jersey during the Civil War. And in 1864, he used his position with the Union Army to travel around the South and really get to know and understand the hundreds of thousands of freed men, women, and children who were making the transition from slavery to freedom. And they really impressed upon him what they wanted in this really unstable period of freedom for them. One, of course, was to reestablish their family connections and so reunite with their families to get married. But they also wanted the opportunity to buy land. And so they would tell him that they didn't want a governmental handout. They actually wanted the ability to work, to save, and to buy land for themselves and their families. And so he understood this. He was really kind of impressed and affected by the conversations that he was having with African Americans. And so in January of 1865, he travels to New York and gathers what at that point was a who's who of progressive Republicans who supported Lincoln. And he encouraged them to support his plan to create a savings bank for the nation's free people.
So how was the bank supposed to function as originally envisioned in the charter?
Sure. Well, the Freedmen's Bank was supposed to be a simple savings bank. It was supposed to be run by a board of trustees, and it was supposed to create branches to receive the deposits of the formerly enslaved. The bank's investment strategy was supposed to be one of low risk. And so the bank's administrators and the bank's board of trustees was supposed to invest a third of the deposits in governmental securities. At this point, we're talking about bonds. Mm-hmm. And so the savings bank was supposed to operate as a simple savings bank to protect the economic interests of the depositors. And it was supposed to operate with the least amount of risk possible to protect their investments.
Was there any effort to include Black individuals in the organization at the outset?
There were discussions. And so in April of 1865, the bank's a newly appointed board of trustees discussed introducing and inviting a Black trustee to the bank's board. And actually the first person that they nominated was a man named Henry Highland Garnett. And they nominated him in May of 1866. And the rationale was that they wanted an African-American man to kind of represent the progressiveness of the bank. Unfortunately, Garnett did not accept the invitation, and it took another year in 1867 for the bank's first Black trustees to be put on the bank's board. And that happened after the bank's official move from New York to Washington, D.C. to kind of be the bank's main office.
Since we're on the early part of it, can you discuss the bank's growth during the early years?
Yes. So the bank grew fairly quickly. In its first year, African Americans deposited about $305,000 into the bank's coffers, which, I mean, at this point, and I say this frequently throughout the book, we're talking about African Americans recently enslaved, depositing hundreds of thousands of dollars into their accounts. And so in the first year, the bank kind of expanded mostly in Virginia and into the Carolinas. But in its first 2 years, the bank had established about 22 branches in about 14 states. And so we are talking about the bank kind of expanding quite rapidly to fulfill the interests of African Americans, especially throughout the former Confederate South.
So $300,000, can we put that in 2024 dollars?
Essentially, we're talking about the first 5 years, African Americans putting about $12.6 million into the bank's coffers. And we're talking about, into today's terms, hundreds of millions of dollars.
And go ahead. Sorry.
Yes.
No, I cut you off. What I was going to say is that's an extraordinary number. I'm sitting here thinking about people who have been enslaved. And they get liberated and all of a sudden there's all this money. What kind of, it must have been so hard for these people to accumulate this money, and it must have been very dear to them to be able to deposit into these banks.
Absolutely. The idea that the formerly enslaved would be working diligently to earn money and to save money and to really want to save money to buy land for themselves and their family was at the kind of core of the bank's mission. And I talk about this in the book, but this is really what I talk about in my first book, Free Markets, that I think it may be easy to believe that the enslaved really kind of had no sense of how to earn money or what kind of money or savings meant. But I show that from the colonial period, the enslaved had been finding ways to illegally earn money, to trade with their enslavers, to trade with one another. And so even though they may not have had kind of sophisticated ideas about finance, they did understand the importance of money. They did understand the importance of saving. And importantly, they understood the economic power of owning land, especially in this kind of period from slavery to freedom. But I think that what this means too is that there was kind of an asymmetry of importance of saving. While African Americans really wanted to use savings account as we might consider a checking account, the bank's administrators really wanted the bank's depositors to kind of leave money in these accounts. But African Americans wanted to kind of put money in their accounts, save as much as they could, and then withdraw money if they wanted to buy land, if they wanted to buy machinery, if they wanted to move. And so we see this tension really start to emerge between African Americans and the bank's trustees and administrators in terms of how they wanted to use the bank for their own purposes.
Let's just talk about the economic fundamentals of the bank. We've got deposits, we've got investments, we've got overhead. How is it supposed to work, and how did it work in those early years in terms of the relationship between those three critical financial flows?
Sure. Well, the bank's administrators and trustees were supposed to invest a third of the deposits in kind of government securities. They were supposed to save a third for overhead, and the last third was supposed to kind of be a discretionary account, kind of just in case there was a run on a particular branch, right? But what happens slowly is that as the bank expands, especially as it expands so quickly in its first few years, it opens branches. In some cities with branches, the bank's administrators purchase buildings. They had to pay branch managers or cashiers, as they were called. And so from the beginning, the bank was operating at a deficit. And pair that with, too, the fact that Black depositors were really not leaving their money in accounts for extended periods of time. We see that the bank was really never profitable, even though it was spending a fair amount of money and time to advertise to Black depositors, encouraging them to deposit as much money in their bank accounts as possible.
Well, now Henry Cook. Who is he, and how did he become involved with the bank?
I kind of feel like we should be playing the dark music as the villain enters from stage
the dark
left.
Right. Well, Henry Cook, I think, is a fascinating historical figure, and he is actually central to my analysis of the bank and its history. So Henry Cook was an investment banker. He was the brother of Jay Cook, and Jay Cook founded Jay Cook & Company. And Jay Cook & Company was the nation's first investment bank. And Jay Cook & Company became both important and incredibly politically influential during the Civil War, because this firm was responsible for selling government bonds to help fund the Union's war against the Confederacy. And so Jay and his brother Henry Cook were bond agents, and they traveled throughout the country. They traveled in Western Europe selling U.S. bonds. And so Henry Cook at this time, in 1867 and 1868, decided to accept the invitation to join the bank's board, especially as the bank's main office shifted from New York to D.C. He was the president of the First National Bank in Washington, and the First National Bank was the D.C. branch of Jay Cook & Company. Henry Cook was incredibly politically astute. One other historian has said that he was the kind of more politically knowledgeable brother, more than Jay Cook. And so he becomes a trustee of the bank in 1867, and he brings with him two colleagues. Their names are William Huntington and D.L. Eaton, and the three of them start to really control the bank's finance committee. And the finance committee was responsible for handling the bank's investments. And increasingly, they decided to convince other members of the Board of Trustees to lobby members of Congress to allow them to amend the bank's charter. And so again, the bank is established as a simple savings bank. And Cook in particular wants the bank to start to diversify their investments, but they can't legally do that under the bank's charter that was ratified by Congress and signed into law by Lincoln. And so they lobby members of Congress, and Congress ends up amending the bank's charter in May of 1870. And the bank kind of shifts from being a simple savings bank to essentially a commercial bank, and they begin to make hundreds of thousands, soon to be millions of dollars in loans.
And again, this was marketed extensively to the African-American community as almost a civic good, right? You can save your money, you can be safe. This was clearly starting to diverge rather substantially from that kind of ultra-safe model that was originally envisioned.
Exactly. The bank was founded, again, as a benevolent savings institution. And the bank's marketing was very clear about this, saying, encouraging African-Americans to, quote unquote, save the small sums, to not buy tobacco and liquor, but instead put your money into the Freedmen's Bank, connecting citizenship and political rights to their participation as depositors in the Freedmen's Bank. But when the bank officially shifts its mission, one from being a savings bank to a commercial bank and making loans and making mortgage loans and business loans, the bank's fundamental mission immediately shifts. And instead, the bank's board of trustees and the bank's administrators begin to seek to chip away at the bank's deposits. They make themselves loans. They make loans to members of Congress. They make loans to their business partners in and around D.C., such that 95% of the loan volume by 1874 went to whites who borrowed money in D.C. Only 5% went to African Americans, and those were primarily Black churches in the city.
Now, were these solid loans? Were these? I know in the book you talk about how in the early days, any kind of loan had to be supported by a collateral that was worth 50% of the loan. I mean, so there was, that was worth twice the amount of the loan. And so were these loans, these sort of insider loans, good solid investments for the bank?
No, they weren't.
What a surprise.
surprise. So one of the major changes in terms of the bank's kind of foundation infrastructure was that the bank could make loans, but the loans had to be secured by collateral two times the loan's value. And so we're talking about bonds, we're talking about real estate. But quickly, the bank's finance committee, again, headed by Henry Cook, began to make loans with kind of faulty security and collateral. And so they would, some borrowers would put up kind of a bond for a company, or put up a piece of property that they themselves did not own that was worth half of the loan's value. And this continued. Really, the bulk of these loans were made between 1870 and 1872, and they disproportionately went to people that members of the Board of Trustees knew and were doing business with.
Hey. Now, Edward Ketchum, what was his role dealing with Henry Cook, Huntington, and D.L. Eaton?
So Ketchum, I think, is seen as being kind of a valiant figure in the history of the bank. He joins the Board of Trustees, and he quickly realizes that Cook, in particular, is using the bank's deposits to fund his own speculative investment ventures at this point. Hook is a major investor in the Northern Pacific Railroad, and he is kind of scrambling to raise money, and he's failing. His previous connections to Western Europe in terms of investors are falling through, and Ketchum is starting to see this. And so in 1872, Ketchum kind of calls Cook to the table and says, look, we are going to call in your loans. And he sees kind of what's going to happen. And this is kind of a game of risk, right? Ketchum is trying to see if Cook is going to bluff or if he's going to pay his debt obligation to the bank, ultimately to the bank's depositors. He doesn't. Ketchum essentially says, well, we need you to kind of step down and step away and pay your debts, such that Cook steps down in 1872. And Ketchum realizes quickly that the bank might not recover. And so kind of Ketchum is that person within the board of trustees who's really trying to call Cook to task for taking advantage of African-Americans' money in terms of their deposits.
This, as I was reading this, I kept thinking about Enron. I have to tell you, I mean, it was just fascinating as the insiders were trading. We don't have much time left, but I think we want to touch it. We have to touch on Frederick Douglass because as Kevin and I were talking before the meeting, before we got on the air, Frederick Douglass becomes the president of the bank, and we were talking about, was he set up to basically be the fall guy and make it look like we could they could blame the African American community for the failure of this bank?
Yes, yes. I mean, Frederick Douglass, again, the most photographed man in America at this period of time, accepts the bank's presidency in March of 1874. He, within weeks, he sits down, looks at the bank's books and finances and realizes that the bank is underwater and has been for most of its existence. And so he says, later on when he publishes his second autobiography, that this was basically one of the worst decisions of his life. And that's saying a lot for a man who was formerly enslaved. And so he realizes that like the bank is going to fail and he is left being the president of the Freedmen's Bank as it collapses. And it is kind of a tough pill for him to swallow. He spends really the rest of his life trying to redeem his reputation for being the president at this really dramatic time.
Now, can we point any fingers at anyone or a group of people in particular who set him up?
Yeah, I mean, we can blame the trustees knowing that they were bringing him in at a point when the bank was irredeemable. It wasn't going to continue to exist. We can blame members of Congress for allowing the bank to shift from a savings bank to a commercial bank. We can also blame regulators. This is a time when the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency was created, was established in 1863, and its sole purpose was to regulate banks. And it didn't do its first examination until 1872. And by this point, a majority of the loans made were made by this time, and they were essentially bad loans. And so there was blame to go around. And unfortunately, no one was prosecuted for their involvement in the bank's failure.
But I take it there were congressional hearings because Congress, even back in the 19th century, Congress never passes up the opportunity to blame somebody.
No, and make a spectacle of it too.
Right.
And so the first congressional inquiry was held in 1876, and it was held by a Virginia congressman named Beverly Douglass. Interestingly, he was a former major in the Confederate Army, and he holds a hearing and basically brings as many of the bank's administrators in to testify. And he gets this on record. He's actually fairly stern in terms of criticizing what this point were were Republicans for allowing the bank to descend into collapse. The second and last hearing was held by one of the first Black members of Congress, Mississippi Senator Blanche K. Bruce, in his kind of final years as being a senator. And he brings in Cook, he brings in Al Vord, and he brings in Douglas to kind of testify. And Bruce recognizes, I think, that nothing is really going to come of this, but he wants to get on record that he brought in the bank's administrators to testify, and he tries to get as much information about the bank's collapse as possible.
The book is The Rise and Betrayal of the Freedman's Bank, Savings and Trust. We've been speaking with the author, Professor Justine Hill Edwards. Professor Edwards, I wish we had some more time, because what I'd really like to talk about is the legacy of the bank in terms of Black trust in financial institutions. And maybe we can have you back for a further conversation.
Yes, I'd love to.
We would love to do that. Today is Veterans Day, a national holiday honoring all American veterans. Here to talk about it is the Honorable Donald Remy, the former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Good morning, Don, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, good morning, Roger. How are you this morning?
Having an excellent day. Don, let's start with a little
bit. Great to be with you again.
Let's start with a little bit about you. Tell us a little bit about your background. What is your military history, and how did you become involved with the VA?
So, you know, my military history begins with my family. I talk about this often, my late father-in-law, brother, uncle, many friends, extended family, and of course, my dad, all served in the U.S. military. Indeed, my father was awarded the Bronze Star for his service in Vietnam. And it's kind of with that military family tradition that I sought and was awarded an ROTC scholarship to attend college, commissioned out of the university, and then served as a lawyer after law school in the Army General Counsel's office. Not combat service like my dad, but honorable service nonetheless. So I've got a deep lifetime of connection to the military.
And how did you become involved with the VA?
So, you know, I've remained involved in service to military members and their families, as well as the related policy issues impacting military members and their families throughout my lifetime. And that involvement likely led President Biden to nominate me to the position of Deputy Secretary, and the Senate to confirm me on a strong bipartisan basis. You know, in shorthand, my role at the VA was kind of the culmination of life's work on behalf of our veteran community and their families.
And now what exactly does your job, what exactly is the job description that you
have? So, Kevin, you know, in shorthand, the role of deputy secretary is to serve as the second in command in the agency, the chief operating officer. When you think about it, VA is the second largest agency in the federal government, approximately $325 billion budget, 1,700 healthcare facilities, 450,000 employees, around 9 million enrolled vets. Think about this as a chief operating officer, 185 million square feet of owned or leased space and 23,000 acres of memorial property. And as the DEPSEC, as they affectionately call the person in the role, you're the chief operating officer of that enterprise.
We want to obviously talk more about the VA, but can we stop for a little bit? Today's Veterans Day. Can you share a little bit about the history and significance of Veterans Day?
Sure. The World War I armistice was signed November 11th, 1918. And Armistice Day was celebrated in 1919 on the first anniversary of the end of the war. And it continues to be celebrated not just in the U.S., but in Europe. By congressional resolution in 1926, it was formalized, and a little more than a decade later, I think, in 38, was named a national holiday. And then in 54, President Eisenhower changed the name to what we have today, Veterans Day. And on Veterans Day, we celebrate generations of women and men, veterans of all wars and periods of restless peace in American history, regardless of when or where they served. And you know, we encourage all Americans to recognize the valor, courage, the sacrifice of our patriots through appropriate ceremonies and private prayers. You know, when I was in office, President Biden often said, and he still says today, our country has one truly sacred obligation: to prepare and equip our troops we send into harm's way, and to care for them and their families when they return, or if they don't. And it's in the spirit of that obligation that we honor those who have served and sacrificed. And even today, he remarked that each veteran and military family represents a link in a chain of honor that stretches back to our founding days, unwavering in their devotion to their loved ones who served in uniform.
Wow, wonderful description. Thank you. Can I jump back over to the VA and can you tell me what are the principal functions of the VA, of the Veterans Administration?
So I'll start with saying what the mission is. And the mission is to fulfill President Lincoln's promise to care for those who have served in our nation's military and for their families, caregivers, and survivors. And I start with that because that's born from a March 1865 Lincoln speech on Pennsylvania Avenue near the Capitol in the final days of the Civil War. Some say it's one of the best speeches he's ever given. And in it, President Lincoln affirmed the government's obligation to care for those who have served our nation in uniform and to care for their families. And so the Department of Veterans Affairs is the federal agency that's responsible for serving the needs of vets and their families. And when you think about that organization, it's divided into three administrations: the National Cemetery Administration, that's the group that provides for burials and memorials that are befitting of the sacrifice of those vets and their families. Mm-hmm. Veterans Benefits Administration, which provides for things like transition assistance and education, home loans, life insurance, other benefits. And the Veterans Health Administration, which provides for medical and surgical and quality of life needs.
I want to focus on healthcare. I don't know that everybody sort of has an awareness that the VA is in the healthcare business, but I don't think people really understand the nature of the healthcare system and who qualifies for what kinds of benefits. Can you sort of start with a big picture of what is the VA healthcare system?
Sure. VA operates the largest integrated healthcare system in the United States. There are 18 what VA calls veteran integrated service networks across the country that captures about 1,300 medical facilities, which includes medical centers and community-based outpatient clinics and other healthcare centers. And the Veterans Health Administration, the healthcare that VA provides, comprises the vast majority of the VA budget to support the direct care for veterans and for their care in the community when necessary. And that includes caregiver and residential support. And simply put, it's an amazing opportunity for those who have served our nation to receive some of the best health care available that can take care of the needs that they have and the circumstances that they're dealing with. So a vet who has served can apply for VA health care and benefits after their service, and they can receive treatment at these healthcare facilities that I've described, the same treatment that you could get in the on the civilian side of the house, if you will, through the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Does it essentially replace health insurance for veterans? Can it cover all their healthcare needs, or does it only sort of act as a supplement?
Yeah, so VA's facilities, they can and they do treat all the same issues that any other healthcare system can treat. Mm-hmm. You know, some veterans have other health care insurance. Some veterans only use the VA system for all of their health care needs, and you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And is that for their family as well?
In some circumstances, family members can receive treatment at the VA healthcare facilities, but that's not all. But there's a TRICARE system that the Department of Defense manages that provides for care for family members of retirees, where they can get health care through the DOD system, oftentimes in the community.
So what is the quality of the care provided? Is the VA healthcare system regarded highly?
It is. Well, let me start with this. You know, there are surveys out there that show that VA hospitals outperform non-VA hospitals across the board in a lot of different areas. Now, you know, the VA system isn't perfect, and I don't mean to suggest that, but the veterans whom we should listen to, the veterans often tell us that they trust the VA healthcare system. In fact, the trust scores of veterans now are, I believe, at a all-time high of around 92%. And so when you listen to the people that are being cared for by the VA system and they tell you that they trust that system to provide the health care that they've earned, I think that is really telling.
And has the trust always been at that level?
It hasn't, you know, and that's why I say no system is perfect, and this is a work in progress, and VA continually tries to make sure that it meets the needs of its customers, the needs of the veterans that use the system. And so there have been times in the past where the trust scores have been lower, but they have been increasing year after year after year as the VA spends more time paying attention to what vets say that they need. And, you know, when I think about it, and I think about one of the things that we would always say when I was the Deputy Secretary of VA, and that's the veteran is at the heart of everything they do. Whenever they make a decision at VA, they ask ourselves one question above all else, and that's, you know, what does it mean for the vet that they serve, for their families, their caregivers, their survivors? And so when you think about it that way, you're better able to increase those trust scores in what you're providing to that community.
So, Don, what is the significance of the PACT Act with respect to VA benefits and the healthcare in particular?
Yeah, well, you know, the PACT Act is the biggest expansion of veteran healthcare and benefits in generations. It makes it so the millions of veterans who fought in American wars, who breathed in debris from sandstorms or fumes from burning trash or chemicals like Agent Orange and more while overseas, that they're taken care of for conditions that follow them home from the wars. So, you know, we're about a little over 2 years in to President Biden signing that historic law, the PACT Act, into law. And at this point, VA is providing more world-class healthcare to vets. They delivered more care to all of the veteran communities, more appointments is what I was intending to say, and have been able to capture an increase year after year of the vets that they're servicing. And so they're decreasing wait times while at the same time increasing the number of vets that are serviced. And a lot of that is due to more veterans coming into the system as a result of the PACT Act.
And is this coverage, were there limits on that kind of, for lack of a better term, inhalation damage? Was that something that wasn't clearly covered before? Is that what this act did? And was that something, were you involved in sort of getting that act together for the VA?
Well, there were many voices that were involved in championing the PACT Act and getting it over the finish line, none more vocal than President Biden and our veteran community. And you're right, Roger. Initially, those types of ailments that might have been the product of exposure to toxic fumes weren't necessarily covered in our system. And so what VA did was initially create presumptive conditions that would allow individuals to be treated. But then when the PACT Act came into being, it allowed for many, many more veterans to be enrolled in the VA healthcare system and increase their opportunity to receive the healthcare and benefits that they previously weren't able to take advantage of.
Now, I imagine healthcare is, mental health care is involved there as well. And I know that suicide among veterans is a continuing problem. What do we know about the underlying causes, and how does the VA try to address the issue?
Yeah, I can't think of anything more important to VA than preventing veteran suicide.
Mm-hmm.
They often say it's the top clinical priority. And to your question, there are a variety of causes of suicidal ideation, and those who deal with those challenges, and whether that's the result of a particular head trauma or the result of an experience, or the result of some other circumstances that are combined together. But we know that more veterans are put in a position where suicide might be viewed by them as their only option than we ever want to have be the case. And so as a result of that, VA has made a significant investment in programs to detect and to prevent incidents of suicide. And so there's a, they approach this from a public health perspective with suicide prevention. They integrate, there's an entire office dedicated to this at VA, and they integrate evidence-based community and clinical intervention strategies and planning and program operations and evaluations of crises over time. And there's a veterans crisis line. You may recall a couple of years ago, there was the 988 suicide line and crisis line that was created. You dial 988, you press one, you get directly into the veteran component of that suicide and crisis lifeline to help you in those circumstances. And I could talk about a number of different programs. There's something called the Staff Sergeant Parker Gordon Fox, Staff Sergeant Fox Suicide Prevention Grant Program that is aimed at reducing veteran suicide. They award grants to eligible entities that can coordinate suicide prevention services to eligible veterans and to their families. And this is, I think, the fourth year of grant funding availability, and the VA has been able to partner with our communities over that time period to make sure that there are services available, not just at VA, but in the community to help deal with these challenges.
One of the most painful things you hear about is when you hear about a homeless person that turns out has been a veteran. So I take it that homelessness, is homelessness sort of a significant problem in the veteran community?
It is, but it shouldn't be. You know, I say all the time, homeless and veteran, those two words, they shouldn't be uttered together. Mm-hmm. No veteran should be homeless in the country they fought to defend. And I know VA is committed to ending homelessness among veterans because, candidly, it's our nation's duty to ensure all veterans have a place to call home. From day one for me, the VA has taken aggressive action to combat veteran homelessness and in all kinds of different ways. You know, I think about when I was at VA and it's continued on efforts that were undertaken in Los Angeles because of the challenges with the homeless population in LA and recognizing that a number of those homeless individuals actually had served our nation. And so in going in the greater Los Angeles area, VA provided vets with temporary and permanent housing and numbers. I don't recall the exact numbers now, but the most of any city in America for many years in a row, exceeding the goals, because VA has goals by region across the country to reduce homelessness to functional zero. And I just recall in LA the success that that VA had in a point in time count, which revealed something more than 20% reduction in vets experiencing homelessness in Los Angeles between 2023 and 2024. So there are a lot of things out there. There's the National Call Center for Homeless Vets. If I may, the 1-877-424-3838. And that's www.va.gov/homeless, where if you're experiencing homelessness and you have a challenge, you can call in and there's somebody there that can help you.
Outstanding. Now, what are there programs to, like loan programs to buy a home or condo for veterans?
Absolutely. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, with respect to the Veterans Benefits Administration, there are a variety of programs that are offered through VABA, one of which is your VA home loan program, where you can get a home loan at a favorable interest rate, and you're able to make that American dream a reality for you. Similarly, there's the GI Bill and the VA education opportunities that have followed on the GI Bill over the years that allow veterans to take advantage of opportunities for higher education.
And of course, the VA loan program, I know I grew up in a home that was purchased with a VA loan, and they were very widespread in the post-World War II era. Is that program still viable? In other words, in the current economic climate, are there mortgages that are realistic for veterans to obtain?
I think so. I mean, yes, the program is still available, and I think that there are mortgages that are available for veterans to obtain that are affordable. Now, the interest rates are what they are today, and and we all recognize that, but VA has a number of programs that will help veterans get in homes and help veterans stay in homes. And that's particularly important to assure that our veteran community that takes out loans to get that first home, that shelter over their head, is not put in a position thereafter where they're going to lose their home. So there are programs, the Veterans Affairs Service Purchasing Program, that provided options to veterans to allow them to retain their homes when traditional loss mitigation options weren't feasible. You know, because we all understand how stressful it can be to face the possibility of foreclosure.
Sure.
And I know VA is committed to doing everything possible to help veterans and their families stay in their homes. And so, you know, in this challenging fiscal environment that you've described, Roger, you know, VA encourages mortgage servicers to implement, you know, foreclosure moratoriums of VA guaranteed homes, which I believe extends through the end of the year, to give veterans and their families more time to explore all of the home retention options and to implement the Veterans Affairs Servicing Purchase Program and have that as a tool to avoid a forbearance and to provide, avoid financial hardship and to enter into forbearance agreements or repayment plans or loan mods to keep vets in their homes.
And before we go, I want to touch on efforts that the VA makes to encourage employment. How does the VA interact with state employment agencies and other programs to sort of help vets find jobs?
So we partner with the Department of Defense and the Department of Labor to provide transition assistance to veterans as they're leaving the military and trying to find that new station in life. This is a challenging point in time in anybody's life, and VA is part of a team that makes sure that vets and their families have opportunities to gain employment in fields that are similar to the work that they have done while they were in the service, or in new avenues that vets want to pursue as they move on. So there's a transition assistance program that is designed to help veterans find that new place, that new station. And like I said, there's partnering with labor and DOD to meet those goals.
Yeah, a friend of mine used the GI Bill to go back to school, and now she's a nurse. So that's,
Okay, Don, and last thing I wanted to touch on, cemeteries. How big an operation does the VA run with respect to cemeteries?
Well, you know, VA has cemeteries all across the country. As I mentioned earlier, there's something like 23,000 acres of land that are used for memorial services. And so while it's a small component of the Department of Veterans Affairs, it's a huge part of the life of the families of veterans who have passed away. And the interesting thing about the VA cemetery system is that it perennially receives some of the highest scores of any enterprise, whether that's public or private, government or commercial, in terms of customer satisfaction in the way that it engages with the family members of those service members that have passed away and how it honors the service of those individuals that have worn the uniform for our nation. And so every single opportunity that the team has at the Veterans Cemetery Administration to make sure that they're delivering on that promise, I know that they take that opportunity and they deliver at a very high level. It's if you've never been to a ceremony that honors the life of a veteran, I encourage you to go and to pay your respects to the sacrifices that they and their families have made for the nation.
And Don, do you have any suggestions as to some ways for our listeners to express their appreciation for the service and sacrifice of our veterans on this Veterans Day?
Well, you know what I just said, there are ceremonies on Veterans Day all across the country. And if, find one near you, you can go to the National Cemetery Administration website and find out where they're celebrating our veterans. And you can go and witness what I've just described, you know, but something more simple, I think, is equally as important. And that's just to reach out to those, you know, and say thank you. Mm-hmm. And don't forget the spouses and the families. Reach out to those who have served and sacrificed for the nation and let them know you appreciate that service.
We just spent a few minutes speaking with the Honorable Donald Remy this morning. Thank you very much, sir.
Absolutely. And thank you for inviting me to be with you on this Veterans Day and to talk to you about the importance of Veterans Day and what it means to our country and to those who have served. The number I had provided was for the National Call Center for Homeless Veterans, and it's 1-877-424-3838. That's on the website, www.va.gov/homeless.
Thank you. We'd like to thank our guests, Professor Justine Hill Edwards and the Honorable Donald Remy.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.